Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of Banal of America, Summer of Strangeness. We're continuing onward here with another what I think will be a fantastic edition of the program. Our guest tonight, I had the pleasure of, I only briefly chatted with him. I regret my time at Ford Fest 2019. I didn't get a chance to talk to as many people as I would have liked. It was a very fast weekend, actually. It seemed to go by very fast. But I had the chance to meet him at Ford Fest 2019 down in Baltimore and enjoyed his presentation quite a bit. And I've been following him on Twitter for a while now. And when I was putting together the Summer of Strangeness, as I said last week on the show, I wanted to talk to folks that haven't been on Banal of America before and feature some new voices that, you know, maybe we haven't talked to at all ever on the show. So Justin Bamforth was on my list of guests, and luckily we got him here on the program tonight. He's an active investigator and a researcher into all angles of the paranormal. He's the author of, I don't know how new it is, it's been out for a couple of years now, the book The Spectrum, Glimpses of the Paranormal and Encounters with the Strange. It contains a lot of really fascinating stories and a lot of firsthand perspectives on stuff that he's investigated and people he's talked to that have had their own strange and unusual experiences. It's a really fascinating book, and I just finished like the last 20 pages this afternoon, so I've been plowing through it this week and really enjoyed it quite a bit. So, and he's also got the website. Let me see. Let me make sure I get it right here. It's Unnormal Paranormal, but I don't know necessarily if I have the. It's always that last part you end up messing up, right, folks? Yeah, there it is. Yeah, see? NormalParanormal.org. See, if I said NormalParanormal.com, who knows where I would have sent you? But he's got the website, NormalParanormal.org. There you can check out. He's got all kinds of stories about, you know, abnormal stuff, strange and unusual, high strangeness, if you will. So, well, I'm looking forward to talking to him tonight. I think we're going to cover a lot of stuff we haven't really delved into much on Banal of America before. So, and that's saying something since we've been around for so long. So, it's going to be a great conversation. Welcome to the show, Justin. It's great to have you, buddy.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start out with the bio, the background. You know, who is Justin Bamforth, and how did you? How did all this start? How did you get mixed up in all this?
Yeah, well, as anyone who works in this field can tell you, Tim, you know, a lot of us, we don't choose to pursue the phenomenon. It tends to choose us for whatever reason. And, you know, like so many others, my origin story, if you want to call it that, it began at an early age as well. However, it really wasn't until I started, you know, Normal Paranormal, which at first was just a little online private discussion group that I had going, and then it evolved into this much larger site, think tank, blog, whatever you want to call it. Things really started to take off, and people started writing in, they started sharing with me their experiences, started posting up some other things. So what you see on the site now at normalparanormal.org is, you know, another incarnation of that name. So I had all these stories. I had my own personal experiences. It was enough to really kind of pull together into a book and just kind of get it out there, share with other people, and hope that it just sparks discussion. You know, I may not have all the answers, but if I can get people to kind of like question things, maybe think about things from different perspectives, then I've done my job.
All right. Yeah, we got people in the chat saying they've got no audio, but we seem to be going all right, and Blog Talk says we're going okay. Very
going
weird.
Men in Black.
Yeah, I know. I know. Very strange. Very strange. Yeah, well, let's see. I'm just going to tell them to keep trying to refresh the page.
Yeah, there you go. Look, you know, sometimes there are technical issues that happen as a result of talking about this subject. Obviously, that's wishful thinking on my part, but you never know. You know, it could just be somebody who doesn't know how to use the stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it says we're on and we're recording and everything, so we're going to just keep rolling, and hopefully the folks trying to hear it on the chat room. Yeah, very weird. Yeah, it says, okay, well, we're going to just keep going because there's nothing else we can do about it because the show says we're going all right. Well, one of the things I found interesting right off the bat in starting the book was that it's kind of reminiscent in a way of how I started out in a sense because I was always sort of not interested in using the word paranormal because it was like so overused. So I would always say the esoteric till people like complained that I said it too much. So what I thought was interesting is that you, and this ties into the book, actually, absolutely ties into the book, you use the term the spectrum to sort of encompass all of this high strangeness. I guess elaborate a little bit on that, you know, the term the spectrum, which I really like a lot. I was like, I was really digging that when I read that in the book.
Yeah, so, you know, these phenomena or whatever we call them, you know, from what I'm looking at it as, they seem to be emanating from one place. You know, whether that place is physical, multidimensional, subconscious, or perhaps something else entirely, you know, it seems like it can take on wildly different shapes, sizes, forms that all seem to fit the perceptions and stereotypes that tend to reflect and mirror our own thinking and beliefs. So that's what I've kind of begun to identify as the spectrum, or this wide gamut of paranormal, supernatural, ufological, metaphysical, whatever you want to call it. It's all strange, and it takes on all these different forms.
Yeah, it's a good catch-all term. It's very difficult to sort of capture all this to try and narrow it down to something. So, I like what you did there with that. Let me see here. Oh, I lost my train of thought. All kinds of craziness going on here already tonight. So you've had a lot of. I was going to mention this at the start of the show. It's kind of like we don't really cover news here, but you were a part of MUFON. So, I mean, what do you think of all this craziness that's happened this week? Are you still a part of MUFON? And what do you think of all this craziness that's happened this week with MUFON? I don't want to put you on the spot on that one, but at the same time, it's like, people are kind of, you know how it is.
Yeah, it's, you know, the organization, it goes through, you know, some highs and lows. You know, recent events have definitely taken it to a new low. You know, I trained, you know, I was thinking about becoming an official MUFON investigator at one point. And then, you know, the more that I sat in on a few of the boot camp sessions, but then the more I learned about their protocols and how they train their investigators, I kind of, you know, disagreed with some of it, and I decided, you know what, I'm just going to go my own route. Yet at the same time, I still support a MUFON because it's a great place that I refer people to when they have a UFO sighting. You know, I get reports all the time, so it's hard for me to kind of, like, investigate every single one, especially, like, you know, a bunch of your lights in the sky cases or experiences. But I've always supported MUFON. I think they're a great organization. There's a lot of other cool UFO organizations out there, but MUFON is certainly the largest. You know, I've attended a lot of their events. I've been in touch with a lot of their people, their leaders, and all that. And Jan Harzan was actually one of the guys that I interviewed for my book. And you know, I didn't know him, you know, as a close friend or on any sort of, you know, real personal level. But you know, I always thought that he was a respectful guy. He always showed me the time of day. He always answered my emails when I sent it to him. So I had no idea that, you know, he had this, you know, allegedly this other thing that he's dealing with. You know, it's unfortunate, and I really just hope that MUFON can, you know, bounce back especially with all the controversy that has kind of like centered around them lately, not just this, but, you know, years prior. I mean, there's a lot of good people in there, and there's a lot of people who are devoted to this field. And, you know, I just hope that it doesn't get overshadowed and it doesn't dissolve. I mean, that I think would be the worst thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very, it's a dark week for ufology. That's probably a good way to put it. One of the darkest mm-hmm. weeks we've had in a while. So it's, you know, for folks who don't know what we're talking about, I'm not going to get into the nitty gritty of it. Just Google MUFON and Jan Harzen and you'll find plenty of, articles and stuff about it. I think, so, you know, just a dark situation. And, you know, it's like you alluded to, it's the organization has been battered over the last few years by controversies in a sense of its own making. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there needs to be, coming out of this, in my opinion, like some kind of like, I wouldn't say reckoning, but like there needs to be some kind of transparency, some kind of bold statement of you know, we recognize that this organization has been taking a beating, and we're going to do our best to sort of like clean it up and turn it around and be transparent and all that stuff that is necessary really to win back the trust, of the people in the UFO world who are really put off mm-hmm. by what's been going on over the last few years, and especially this past week. So, there you go. So I guess, the people in the chat still can't hear us, so we're going to keep going. I mean, it says it's recording, and so we're just going to keep going. So if by okay. some bizarre turn of events, this episode ends up like missing somehow, you and I'll figure it out. We'll do another one or something. I don't know, but it says the Blog Talk says we're rolling. So I don't know what is going on their end. So, anyway, we don't have, we can't, there's nothing else we do, okay. So, right?
Okay.
It's very disorienting when you're doing a show, like, live, and then people are like, I can't hear it. It's like, well, we can't just stop the show and start over, so, you know, it's like, we got to just go with what we got going on, and the thing says we're going, so. Now, let's talk about one incident in the book. I have a theory on it. I didn't allude to it in the notes I sent you, because I want to kind of pop it on you myself. So tell this story about your visit to the cable company and the weird premonition that occurred while you were there.
Right. Yeah. So that's, that took me by surprise for sure. And a lot of times with this phenomenon, like, you know, you can't anticipate it. You can't predict when something strange is going to happen. And a lot of times when you go looking for this, that's when it doesn't happen. It's always when you're least expecting it. And in this case, I was I was really frustrated, first off. I was, dealing with a cable company that shall not be named. And, there was an issue where the apartment complex that I lived in, they told me to keep the cable box in the apartment because they supplied the free cable. And meanwhile, this cable company was telling me I had to return the cable box. So I go to the call center just to kind of sort it out. And, you know, I remember, you know, being there in the waiting area. And first off, they had bulletproof glass separating the customers from the employee. Yeah, so that should have been my first red flag right there. But and it didn't help. So I'm already stressed out at that point. And then all of a sudden, like, I'm in there and I just get this feeling, just this really sinking suspicion that my car is going to get hit. And it came out of left field. Why would it get hit? You know, I parked in a safe spot, and I'm like rationalizing this in my mind. I'm like, why am I thinking this? You know, and it was like an overwhelming sense of dread, like something was going to happen here. Then I remember there was, if I recall, there was another person in the room, in that waiting room area. And then all of a sudden, some other person came flying into the waiting room, and they came right to me, and they said, I forget exactly what vehicle I was driving, but I think in the book I refer to it as like a black Chevy, but like, you know, they came up to me and they're like, you're the one who drives the black Chevy, right? You know, and I'm like, I guess. And then, the other person in the room, they said, hey, that's my car. or I'm sorry, yeah, they had told me, they said, hey, you drive this car. It wasn't my car. It was the other person's car. They recognized it, and then that person went out. So sure enough, they had hit their car. So I had, in essence, a premonition meant for the other person in the room. So how is that possible? You know, I always thought that premonitions are meant for the person who has the premonition, right? You know, I was talking with a school teacher in Philadelphia who happened to be my my hairstylist at the time. And she was, you know, was relating this incident. And she told me, oh, my gosh, like a similar thing happened to me, too, where she had a premonition meant for somebody else. And it's so funny that you bring this up because I was doing another show just last night. And that host before the show was telling me, hey, I read that part and the same thing happened to me. So is there something to this? Are people having premonitions meant for others? You know, why is that? You know, again, I tend to think that maybe there's this connection with our mental state. You know, I was really stressed at the time. The school teacher in Philadelphia was really stressed. I still have to ask the show host if she was stressed, but it's really bizarre, right?
Yeah, well, what's strange is here's the theory I had reading the book. Now, you were really stressed out, and you were waiting to talk to the guy at the thing, right? And
yep.
The guy at the desk, and you let someone ahead of you, right? And then you had the premonition that your car was hit. And then the guy came in and thought that he had hit your car, but it was actually the guy you had let ahead of you. I'm wondering if by you letting the guy go ahead of you, you inadvertently spared your car from the accident somehow. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's really interesting take on it. Very interesting. You know, it's almost like, well, it leaves you wondering, like, if my, you know, quote-unquote essence was still there, and maybe he had somehow, I don't know, intercepted it or something, or maybe, I don't know. This, you brought up now a lot of questions for me to think about. This is great. I love it. And that's why.
Yeah, because that was my first thought reading. Mm-hmm. That was my first thought reading reading that story, because it was like you thought your car was hit. I don't know. It just seemed like if you had been in a spot where you had let the guy go, that guy's car was the one that was hit. So it's like, that's weird, you know?
Yeah, there's again with this, there's never any answers. There's just more questions, and it's both, you know, fascinating and frustrating beyond belief. But that's great, Tim. Like now I got to think about this.
Yeah, that was a very odd story. That was a very odd story. Now, talk a little bit about crisis apparitions. I thought this was really interesting because this is like there's a lot of stuff in the book that I hadn't really encountered before or heard about, some really sort of nuanced characters, if you will. So, you know, but talk about this phenomenon of crisis apparitions.
Yeah, so crisis apparitions is one of those things that you don't hear about a whole lot, but it could be, in essence, like a bilocality thing. It's where somebody will report seeing a ghost or an apparition, if you will, of somebody. And I've heard reports that it'll happen, like, for example, you'll have like a Jane Smith like hanging in her house doing dishes. And then all of a sudden, she'll see the apparition of her husband in the kitchen. And she'll be like, what are you doing here? Like, you're home from work early or whatnot. Unbeknownst to her, her husband is involved in a car wreck several miles away. And for whatever reason, it seems like there's this connection between traumatic events and the people that are witnessing these apparitions. There's this connection. Now, what is that? You know, in essence, if you want to go by the classic definition of a ghost or an apparition, that would be a ghost or an apparition, right? But they're not deceased. So it kind of like changes the whole view of what a ghost is. But they tend to show up during these crises or these moments of extreme trauma. And one of these great examples is involving a woman named Rhea Baker, who I had interviewed, and she didn't want to reveal her full name because she was still going through med school at the time. But she was in the midst of a residency at a hospital in Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania, working the overnight shift when a man came in who had apparently OD'd on heroin and was brought in unconscious. Now, it was suspected that the man had undergone like these violent seizures since the first responders who discovered his body discovered it like just contorted in all sorts of these awkward positions. So they brought him into the ER to do surgery, right? So yeah. Later that same night, Rhea was walking the floors at about, I don't know, like 1 or 2 in the morning, and she noticed the same man out in the hallway. But this time the man was in a wheelchair and just staring down. So she went up to him and, you know, she said something along the lines of like, you know, can I do anything for you? And the man just looked up at her and just shook his head. And for some reason, Rhea just, you know, kind of like patted him on the shoulder and walked away. Now, I bring this up because with these phenomena, it's people respond in the strangest ways. They respond out of character. And this is something that Rhea admitted to me that she would have never done. You know, usually she would have, you know, just taken him back to his room or gotten another nurse to assist. But she just, you know, patted him on the back, walked away. 20 minutes later, she hears code blue, which is apparently a cardiac arrest alert, and the room number. So she goes in there, and it's the same room number as the man she had seen just moments prior in the wheelchair. But the thing is, according to the records, this man never regained consciousness. And he also had both of his legs amputated to the knee and one arm amputated to the elbow. So how on earth did she see this man fully intact with all of his limbs just moments ago when that couldn't have been? And, you know, according to the records, the man had never been responsive in any way. So what did she see? Now, she was not close to this man, so that kind of like throws the whole, you know, personal connection off. Why her? She is an empath. She does have abilities. So maybe she was just on the right wavelength that night to see him. I don't know. It's bizarre, but again, it leaves you wondering, what is a ghost?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that your book brings up that question a lot, in a sense, where it's like there are a lot of different, like you just described, there are a lot of different forms that are almost like non-traditional ghosts that we know of. You know, it's a, sort of like the idea of like, you know, the classic sort of ghost where it's like it can see you and it's from the, you know, it's a deceased person. Or sort of the stone tape theory, like those are the two main ones. But you're like these crisis apparitions, like a whole different animal. It's a whole mm-hmm. different type of entity, if you will. It's very flummoxing, very confounding.
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of really, you know, people always ask me, well, you know, do you believe in ghosts? Well, I can't answer that because I don't know what a ghost is. You know, do I think it's a deceased individual? Yeah, sometimes. Do I think it's a psychic imprint or something tied to, you know, projected manifestation that somebody inadvertently does? Sometimes. Could it be an aspect of time travel or time slips? Yeah, possibly. I mean, it's all of these things. It's not quite, this isn't quite a black and white issue. It's very complex. It has a lot of layers to it. And, you know, I always encourage paranormal researchers to kind of, and investigators to branch out, to kind of rethink what they believe these things to be. And maybe then we'll actually get somewhere in the field. Who knows?
I thought it was really interesting, too, that over the course of the book, you detail a fair amount, not just that incident at the cable company, but a lot of interesting – you've had a lot of experiences. Why do you think it is that you've had so many unique experiences? Because I've never had anything really out of the ordinary that even book-worthy and it happened to me. So it's like, so I was reading the book. I was like, geez, this guy has a lot of weird stuff happen to him.
Yeah. And it's, like I said, it happens when you least expect it. You know, when I'm out looking for things, I never experience anything. It happens when I'm, you know, not looking for it, but I could be focused on it. You know, it also happens to people connected with me as well, which another aspect that we can get into with like Men in Black and such. But it's like, to answer that question, I don't know. You know, maybe it's because I'm thinking about these things so often that I kind of like send out like a beacon into the supernatural world and say, hey, here I am. But
yeah,
you know, or maybe it's something tied, you know, generationally. You know, when you look at people who have had a lot of experiences, it seems to run in their family. And that's one of the questions I started asking when I interview them. You know, tell me a little bit about your family history. You know, have you always had experiences? Have your parents had experiences? What about your grandparents? You know, when we look at the alien abduction phenomenon, that seems to be the case. So is there something, you know, that's tied to a family lineage in a way? Maybe. Can you invite it in if you're kind of like conjuring these things up? Yeah, that's another possibility too. You know, there was a time when, you know, I was going on a lot of cases, and after I would be finished the cases, things would follow me back, and they would just linger around for, you know, a couple of days at a time, and then they would just dissipate. You know, why is that? It's almost like a paranormal debris or like a residue, if you will. Again, there's so many questions. Like, I don't know. I can only offer speculation. I can only offer theories, but I've noticed that there is a pattern. Certain people that seem to be predisposed to this, and they seem to have more experiences than others. So it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Part of me wonders if it's like you're more open to receiving them or something like that. But I'm not sure. Like, it's all open to speculation, you know, because or maybe it's like once you've had a few, it kind of opens the door to more stuff happening. You know what I mean? So I've never had anything happen. So it's like the door is not quite open enough for me or something like that.
Yeah, it could be. It could also, you know, could be tied to, you know, how we view the world too. You know, for example, you know, I tell people that I am a very, you know, spiritual person. You know, I consider myself a Christian. You know, when I've been praying in certain respects, I've had experiences. Which is really interesting. You know, here's one. I was walking on the street one time and I was praying for somebody, and there was a man who was walking towards me. He just looked like a normal man, and I literally looked down for a split second, looked up, and he's gone. You know, I did not recognize this man, but where I was walking, there was a huge building to the side of where we were. Unless he jumped like, you know, 50 feet into the air and leapt over the top of the building, you know, where did he go? I don't know.
Right.
He literally vanished. You know, I can't explain that. I don't know why. And there was, in my mind, there was no point as to why that happened. So, you know, a lot of these things happen. We have no answers, but the experiences seem to be tailored to certain, for certain people. So it's almost like, when somebody has an experience, as investigators and researchers, we have to kind of like not focus on the experience itself, but look at how that experience transformed the witness or the experiencer. You know, how did it reshape their thinking? Maybe that's why the experience took place to begin with. So maybe there's, you know, I don't want to get all new agey, you know, I'm who knows, but maybe there's, you know, maybe there's a journey that, I don't know, that you have to be on at some point, and then you'll start to notice a lot of these things. I don't know. Again, all speculation.
Right, right. It's very odd. So when did you, I guess, how long and sort of when did you start doing these sort of on-site investigations? Because it's a very, I know this isn't really in the notes we talked about, but it's sort of just something that piqued my interest just now. So like when did you start doing these, and how long have you been doing on-site investigations? Talk a little bit about all that stuff, because I don't talk to too many people on the show who have done. I think we had John Tenney on like 3 weeks ago, and he, you know, he's done like thousands of those. But aside from John and a handful of other folks like the Newkirks, you know, we've only had like maybe 5 or 6 guests at most who have done these on-site investigations, and I find them fascinating. I've only done like 2 of them, and they didn't, as I alluded to earlier, that nothing happened. So, you know, so to me, it's like, I'm fascinated by people who have done them and had interesting stuff happen. So I guess talk a little bit about how you got into doing that, you know, how many you've done, some of the more memorable incidents, I guess, that occurred while you were doing these, you know, or you know, like whatever your favorite one is or most memorable.
Well, you know, I can tell you, I certainly haven't done thousands, you know, so I've done a lot. I've done a lot less, but, you know, I started going out, you know, when I was approaching like 18, you know, I started connecting with a lot of local paranormal groups and started kind of like learning the ropes, started going out to like a lot of historical places, a lot of haunted locations, kind of getting my feet wet, so to speak. And then, you know, word gets around, hey, this guy is interested in these things. This guy is doing these investigations. And then, you know, friends started inviting me to their other friends' houses who are having activity. And then before you know, I'm doing a lot of residential cases. And I really prefer the residential cases because, you know, you're really helping somebody. You're looking to help somebody. You're looking to kind of like consult with somebody and help them to better understand what is taking place. Now, a lot of times, nothing is taking place. A lot of times, it's wishful thinking. People, you know, they want their house to be haunted or they want to have experiences. A lot of people are like, I want to be abducted. Why you would wish that, I don't know. But, you know, a lot of it can be explained away under normal circumstances. But every once in a while, they'll come away with a case that, can easily be explained away, at least not under normal circumstances. So those fascinate me. You know, I use that as a way to kind of, you know, connect with people. But here's something you don't really hear about with investigators is, you know, when you do an investigation, right?
Yeah.
You get to go home at the end of the night. You get to go home to your bed, your safe, you know, place. People who are enduring these things, they don't have that luxury. They have to deal with it. So it's the responsibility of the investigator to stay in touch with those people and to what I consider, you know, form like a lifelong friendship with them, because you never know when that activity will suddenly come back. You know, a lot of times people think, oh, this is like Ghostbusters, right? You just bust them and they're done. You put them in an ectocontainment unit and that's it. Well, no, it's not the case. Sometimes this activity is tied to the people. Sometimes it's tied to the location. It's really hard to tell a lot of times. Sometimes there's mental illness involved. Sometimes there is both. You know, but I connect with a lot of groups. You know, a lot of groups come to me, a lot of independent investigators come to me as well, and they say, hey, we have this case. We'd like your input. We'd like your perspective. Because, again, I'm looking at it from the whole spectrum of activity, you know, what is taking place. And sometimes you find out that you have a UFO investigator there just interviewing them about the UFO sighting. They won't think to ask about the paranormal stuff. And that happens a lot, or, you know, vice versa with paranormal investigators. So I've been on enough cases to where I think that there is something happening here. Again, I can't say definitively what it is. Some of the most memorable cases I've been on, you know, they're far and few in between. You know, a lot of this is boring, you know, like you've experienced, you know, you're sitting in a room for hours on end, nothing's happening, nothing will. Maybe there's like a second of activity that takes place. It's not like the TV shows, but every once in a while you'll get a case. I mean, it's interesting. Nowadays, I don't do nearly as many cases. Most of the time, it's me talking with somebody, and, you know, they're just calling me up or they're emailing me, and they just want to understand why they're experiencing things, why it's taking place to them, maybe pinpoint or better understand, you know, the triggers, you know, what could have caused it. They're just looking to understand it a little bit more. You know, it's very intrusive for people to have a whole team of investigators into a location, you know, tearing up the place, you know, with all their high-tech equipment. You know, it's not what people are looking for, you know. So my role has kind of changed over the years, less investigating, more consulting. And I prefer it that way. But every once in a while, I will go out, and obviously not now in these crazy times, but I'll go out, I'll meet with people. It's a process, though. It's definitely a process.
It seems like that. It seems like that. Now, you tell a story in the book that is absolutely riveting, and this is the Lawrence Miller case. I take it this is someone that contacted you with this story, and I was like on the edge of my seat reading this story. So share this account, you know, as best you can with the listeners and get an understanding of sort of, I guess you could say, the kind of stuff that you consult on. Like, was this guy just sort of reaching out to you to be like, hey, listen to this crazy thing that happened to me, Justin. I don't know what to make of it. It's kind of what how he was framing it, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it's really interesting because, again, how I mentioned early on in this show, you know, when I started normalparanormal.org, it went through a lot of different, you know, iterations of the site. And one of those iterations, I had asked people to help contribute articles to the site because I thought it was important to get other people's perspectives. And one of these guys who was following me on Twitter, you know, I refer to him as Lawrence Miller. I'm not his real name, but he was an avid reader of the site. And, you know, he contacted me and he expressed interest in writing the topic. So I said, sure, you know, what's it gonna be about? And he mentioned living in a haunted house scenario that had taken place not too long after he wrote to me. So, okay, no problem. He sent me a draft. You know, again, I had no clue what this was going to be about. And he just touched on the effects of it, you know, how it really bothered him and how it really messed him up. And at that point, I knew that there was something to this. And again, he wasn't looking to get into the details, but I thought it was intriguing. So I asked him if I could interview him more in depth about it. Now, he was extremely reluctant at first, but when I mentioned, you know, later that it would be for a book and it might possibly help others in whatever it is that they're dealing with, step four or two, you know, he finally agreed. But when I interviewed him, he had a very tough time telling me about it. You know, for your listeners, here's the general synopsis. This guy, he took a promising job offer in South Carolina. And so he relocated his family from Houston, Texas, all the way there. But when he moved into the new house, things kind of took a turn for the worst. And these unusual occurrences just like escalated into full-blown sightings of what I would describe as like demonic imp-like creatures. And they tormented Lawrence and his wife daily for a long time. They lived in the house for 2.5 years, which they found out later was the longest that anybody had ever lived in that house. So he retreated back to Texas after that, and it messed him up. I mean, he was diagnosed with having PTSD from the incident. And then I found out later on that it actually, you know, apparently he got, if I recall, like an MRI done after he moved back to Texas, and they noticed that the one receptor in his brain that responds to fear literally got fried. How do you make that up, right? Like, how do you do that? So when I interviewed him, you could tell in his voice that he was still struggling. And because as he was telling it, all of these memories are coming back, you know, coming back up again. You know, this, again, for your audience, this ruined this man's life. You know, this is not a pleasant haunting. This was not like a movie. It did not have a happy ending. He ended up getting a divorce. The haunting pushed him to drink. It was terrible. And he still suffers from it. But talking about it more actually helps him because it helps him to process these things. You know, it's a sad tale, but I guess in a way it has a kind of a positive ending. You know, it actually led him to join a paranormal group in Houston then, where he could then help other people. And I've noticed when people endure these things, again, if we're talking about the transformative effects of these experiences, people either, you know, they run from it or just pushes them to the brink of darkness, or they look at it from a more positive angle and they use it to help other people. And in this case, here is a man who did. He used it to help other people. And because when he was experiencing it, he didn't know who to go to. You know, he had a Jewish faith, but his faith had no leaders who wanted to deal with this. So he went to, you know, the Catholic Church, and it seems like they're the only ones who were equipped to dealing with this, but it didn't work. He approached it from a Native American, you know, perspective with the, you know, with all the rituals and such. That didn't work. Nothing worked. So what do you do? You know, when you've exhausted all your resources and all your help out there, what do you do? Who do you go to? Fortunately, other people now can go to him. And since the book was published, he also has his own podcast, and I went on his podcast, and he came public with it, and he told his audience, you know, that he was the person portrayed in the book, and he still doesn't like to make a big deal of it, but yeah, it's fascinating account. So that's kind of how I met him.
Yeah, it's very troubling. And has anyone like gone back to this place to investigate it? You know, since the story's come out, since he's told his story, because it seems like it would be rife for someone to check out if it's like this recurring thing wherein, you know, everybody who's lived at the property every 2 years, you know, bails out on it. Seems like it has the repeatability that you're looking for in the paranormal, in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, to my knowledge, nobody has looked into it. I have the address. It's on my to-do list of things. You know, the first thing I'm going to do is write a letter to the house to see if anybody responds. You know, it's a very troubling thing, but then again, I also have to be very cautious too, because if I have this, you know, beacon out there, you know, is the activity gonna hone in on me? You know, it's something that, you know, the supernatural tends to get underestimated. Especially in its power. You know, a lot of times we like to think that we're in control, or that we can, you know, bathe ourselves in a white light and be protected or whatnot. But let's be honest. It, whatever it is in control. And it will do whatever it damn well pleases. You see that at places like, you know, hot spots like a Skinwalker Ranch. You know, they still can't explain what's going on out there. But it has affected people on a physical level, emotional level, you know, a psychological level. It's uncanny. This stuff is dangerous. Let's be honest. It's very dangerous. And it does follow certain people. Fortunately, in Lawrence Miller's case, it did not follow him. It stayed centered on the property. But who's to say it won't follow somebody else? So, again, you know, there's a lot of questions I have to ask myself, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, be careful for sure, because it sounded like one of those, like a troubling sort of thing. You got to really steel yourself if you're going to look into it. But definitely felt like something, like I said, it had that repeatability factor where it's like most of the time you're not necessarily sure what you're going to get. But if this keeps happening all the time to everybody who moves in, it'd be interesting to talk to who lives there now to see if they're experiencing anything. That might. Like you said about writing a letter, it's like that might be the best thing to do, because they may be sort of wandering around in the wilderness right now, uncertain as to what the hell is happening, and they may not even know, because, you know, the address isn't in the book or anything, like even the town or whatever isn't in the book, I don't think. So it's like they would have no idea that they're living in this haunted house that's been written about and everything else. So it would be, you know, maybe with the letter, send them just tear out the chapter of the book and send that with them and be like, yeah, this is your house. This is your house that is mentioned in the book. So if anything's going on, call me. You know, maybe we can get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, this is definitely not a case closed. That's for sure. So
yeah, absolutely. It sounds fascinating. And there are, you know, there are sort of stories of these, like, demon houses in various parts of the country. So it's not, like, completely unheard of that there are these sort of houses that are just, you know, nightmare experiences to live in. And various people experience them as they move in and out of the place. So it's like, oh, it's clearly the property, something off about it. Now, at one point you talk about I think you kind of alluded to this earlier, but you don't do investigations as much, that you reevaluated your purpose in the field. I guess talk about sort of that decision that you made and what went into that.
Yeah, so the more I talk with people over the years, and it's interesting because some groups, they have me talk to the people now, it's just to kind of get like an overview, before they go investigate. When you interview a witness or an experiencer of the phenomenon, like they may not reveal everything that has ever happened to them during your initial conversation. That's why I like to keep the dialogue open and the conversation going. In a lot of these cases, like I mentioned earlier, you know, the events continue to occur long after that initial experience, you know, has officially ended. A great example of this is the case of Shane Sovar, who I talk about in my book. You know, he's a guy who had a UFO experience and some haunting activity, and then a Men in Black encounter, or Men in Black, rather, which was even caught on camera. I met up with him and his wife back in December of, oh man, we're in 2020 now. I think it was December 2018, maybe, after the book had been published. And his wife started telling me even more stuff that took place, which I had not been privy to at the time. So, it's interesting. It's like people only tell you what you're asking, but there's so much more. And you have to gain their trust, right? It's like if you go out, you know, and you meet somebody new, you're not going to tell them your whole life story. You have to feel comfortable with them first. And with a lot of these strange things, people don't know how to process it, and they're still, you know, trying to wrap their heads around it. So it takes some time. So I encourage others who are involved with this, you know, be patient with the person. You know, they may be reluctant to open up to you, but just take some time, get to know them as a human being, as an individual, and then they'll share with you things that are really fascinating. Another case I looked at in the book was the Gary Sudbrink case. And this is a man who had he had some weird phone calls to its residents, and he had some strange events throughout his life. But I was talking with his father and his one brother last year, and it was fascinating because they had more experiences that they had not shared with anybody. And I was like, wow, this is a family who seems to follow certain families. So, you know, I tell people, keep it open, keep the discussion open. That's what I've learned. And I love it. I love talking with people, meeting with people, just seeing what their story is. And, I can't prove it. I can't disprove it. I wasn't there when it happened. That's not my job anymore. My job is just to listen and just to put it out there in the hopes that it may be something that encourages somebody else to come forward with saying, hey, look, I've experienced that too. I just never knew that. I thought I was the only one. And then they'll share their story. You know, it's like the doppelgangers. I know those stories are out there, but you rarely hear about them, right? That's why I included some of these stories in the book.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I've said this before in the past. Like, you look at people like it's a very – and I'm sure it happens, I guess, with the haunting people too. I'm not as deeply invested in that realm as I am with the UFO world. But it's like you talk about – like somebody who's been abducted by aliens, you know. It's they immediately – they're not necessarily – to a lot of people who are researching this, they're not like – I mean, they're people, obviously. They're people. But at the same time, they're like a specimen. And they're like someone to be studied almost. And I can imagine that it's a very off-putting experience for someone. Not only you've been abducted by aliens, but now you're sort of the subject of this fascination of researchers or a group of people or who are pouring, you know, or doubting your story or pouring over your story and sort of put you under a microscope. And it's like, so you're like almost doubly traumatized in a way. And I can imagine that's the same for somebody who's experienced a haunting and everything like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, we have to be very, very delicate in interacting with these people and approaching them. You know, I've reached out to lots of people and they've just flat out just denied me. You know, they're not interested in talking to me. They're not interested in sharing their story with anyone. You know, a lot of people seem to just be very afraid of how the public is going to respond to their story. And rightfully so. You know, you brought up, you know, with alien abduction. I mean, there's this stereotype with that and the stigma, you know, still in talking about it, that you're going to have all these things done, you know, these anal probes, and you're going to, you know, you're a wacko, you're part of the new age crowd. And it just isn't the case. But yet that's how the public views this a lot of times. And especially the stuff that you can't easily categorize. People just have a tough time dealing with this. And I've made a lot of friends in this field, but I've also lost a lot of friends too as a result of it. So it's disturbing. I won't lie. It's a very disturbing subject. And there are times that I wish I wasn't involved with this. I wish I was just leading a normal life, you know, where instead of talking to you on this show, I could be out at a nightclub or something, you know, having a good time. It just doesn't seem to be the case. I'm brought into this for whatever reason. And, you know, I end up connecting with people, sometimes under the most synchronistic of circumstances, which also blows my mind. It's almost like, you know, people are led to other people. It's this other part of the phenomenon that I've started to look at now. You know, why are things happening the way that they do? Again, it gets into philosophical discussions and all sorts of other questions, but yeah.
Well, at the risk of dredging up painful memories, you mentioned that a few times in the book that you've lost friends because of the because of your research. Like, how did that – how did – if, like I said, I don't want to, like, poke at a nerve or whatever, but like, you do mention in the book a few times, and it did strike me as interesting and something I kind of made a mental note of, where it was like, oh, that's, you know, that's disappointing, but like, I don't necessarily, hasn't happened to me. So I'm wondering how exactly did that happen? You know, what, give me sort of an idea of what you mean by having lost friends because of your work in the field.
Well, I mean, a lot of times people think, you know, they believe what they see on the movies, and they think that the phenomenon operates in a super scary manner, right? It's there to terrorize people. In some cases, yes, that may be. But a lot of it is not like that. It tends to be very startling. It tends to be very unpredictable and sporadic. But again, it's that control aspect. And we as human beings, we like to be in control. We like to know what's going to happen next. That's why a lot of times people are so afraid of this topic, because it's the fear of the unknown. They don't know what it is, let alone how it operates. So sometimes when I'm talking about this subject with people, strange things can happen right before our eyes. And, you know, it could be just coincidence. A lot of times it is. But every once in a while, something will happen where I have to be very careful, you know, and I just laugh it off. It's just, you know, whatever. But there, you can tell, you can see it in their face. They're shaken up or, you know, or shook by this, you know. My ex-wife, she, you know, she believed that this stuff does happen. She witnessed a lot of it happen in our home, and it was very unsettling for her. And, I could just see the look on her face during a lot of these things. And it wasn't cool. But again, I'm not in control of that. You know, these things happen on their terms. So, you know, it fascinates some of us in the field, but we have to keep in mind the public at large is not fascinated by it. They are scared of this. That's probably why they don't get into this. That's why they don't talk about it a lot. That could be why, again, this is just a theory, why news media tends to, not nowadays with the UFO subject, but before that, they used to turn this into a mockery, right? If you go to like a scary movie and you watch the crowd's reaction to scary scenes, they will jump, but then they'll also laugh. And I've noticed that there's it's a way to process the fear. So I've always wondered if perhaps news media is doing the same thing. You know, they turn it into a joke because it helps them to process it, to keep it kind of like at a distance. Like, it's just nonsense. Cue up the X-Files music. The thought.
That's a great point, because that's a big complaint about the media coverage of the paranormal. But then when you think about it, that is kind of like how people react to things that are frightening, is they kind of like laugh it off. So it's, you know, they have a laugh afterwards. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Another point you make in the book that I really, that resonated with me was that you note how one of the big complaints is like, oh, people see a UFO or they see a ghost or whatever, or a Bigfoot or something. It's like, well, why didn't they take a picture? And it's like, well, look, if you encountered something, you didn't know what it was. And like, if somebody jumped out of a dark alley at you while you're walking down the alley, like your first thought wouldn't be, I need to take a picture of this thing. It would be like, I need to make sure that I'm safe. I need to respond in a way that ensures my safety. And so no wonder like a lot of people don't take pictures of this stuff. So that sort of resonated with me in a way. It's like, that makes a lot of sense that I haven't really heard explained in a way before. So kudos to you on that observation in the book.
Thanks.
Now, another observation you make, which I found interesting, this is sort of a little bit inside baseball, but I've been to a lot of different conferences. I haven't been to enough ghost events to really take in sort of the feel of them. I've been to sort of general events, sort of like the Fort Fest where we met, and Strange Realities Conference last year in Nashville was kind of like a multi-pronged event also. So I haven't been to really one of these pure ghost events. I really do want to go and check one out. There's a lot around here in New England. Maybe once this pandemic thing comes to an end and there's more conferences again, I'll be able to check one out. But you make an observation that I think that I'm interested in finding out more of. That you say that the structure and sort of the presentation of the two different types of conferences, UFOs and ghosts, there's a distinct difference between the two types of conferences. So I guess tell me a little bit about your observations on that, because I haven't necessarily been schooled enough in the two different types. I've been to a lot of UFO events and a fair amount of cryptozoology events, so I can kind of get an idea of the tenor between those two. But as far as the ghost ones go, your book really made me think to myself, like, I need to go to one of these ghost events, because I've never been to a ghost conference before. So I definitely want to go check one out now, having read the book. But tell me sort of your observations on the differences between these gatherings, if you will.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting, because with the UFO events, and you can certainly speak to this, it seems to be they're approaching it very scientifically, you know, and I'm scientific, very loosely, you know, but more scientific than a lot of these paranormal events or paracons, if you will. You know, the people presenting their data are very, you know, they're presenting it in a way that's very very dry. You know, it's very and I don't mean this in a bad way at all, and I don't mean to slam any of the people involved, but it's like they're focused on the data, and with you know, the presentations and everything. With the paranormal events, it's more of like a social gathering. It's more of like, hey, this is kind of cool. This is unique. This is neat. It's fun. And I've always wondered if perhaps that's because there's a lot more paranormal entertainment out there. And it's kind of made it kind of like a hip thing. Now we have to think, prior to all of these shows, right, prior to the paranormal entertainment movement, if you will, if you were involved with the paranormal, you were considered practicing black magic or involved in the occult and witchcraft and all that stuff. You were like, that was taboo, right? That wasn't cool. Now it seems to be kind of like a little trendy. With the UFO stuff, I still don't think it has really caught on yet. And it hasn't really been cool. It's cooler, if you will, but it attracts a different type of audience. It attracts a much older audience that grew up with a lot of this stuff. But I tend to think, in some respects, the UFO field is in danger of dying off, because when I go to both of these events, I see a totally different crowd. I see a much younger crowd at the paranormal events than the UFO one. Yet really, it should be the same crowds going to both. I rarely see an older crowd at the paranormal events. You know, why is that? You know, this is all high strangeness. And we need to approach it as that. You know, I had a a good conversation with Colonel John Alexander at a MUFON conference one time that he was speaking at. And he had mentioned, you know, let's just have a strange experiences conference. Let's not label it anything, not a UFO con, not a paranormal con, nothing. Let's just look at it at face value for what it is. Let's look at the data. Let's present it in such a way that is that engages the audience and gives them some information. You know, it's really fascinating, but it's also unfortunate. And I love going to both for different reasons, but I think that both of them could do better blending this these various fields. And for goodness sake, invite the cryptozoological researchers to your conferences, you know?
Yeah.
Because they're studying this and they're coming across interesting findings. Like when we were at Ford Fest, right, with Timothy Renner and Joshua Cutchin. They're working
right.
on a book. I'm not sure if it's been released yet, but it was looking at all of the underreported aspects of cryptozoology, of the Bigfoot. There's a lot of paranormal tie-ins with that, a lot of UFO tie-ins with that. That is what we should be looking at. And, you know, that was one of the reasons why I kind of did not become a formal MUFON investigator, because they train their investigators, I don't know if this is still the case, but just to look at the experience that they reported, and that's it. Do not take an interest in the person's life or dive into their whole backstory. And I understand why they would have it as a protocol. You know, some people will just keep on talking. But there could be some clues in that backstory. You know,
the witness is key to the whole thing. So, yeah, you got to kind of.
Yeah.
It's almost
right.
like as risky as it is that you're going to just spend too long talking to them. It's like that's,
right.
you know, that might be the key to the whole thing. So it's. To dismiss it out of hand is like that's not counterproductive, I think, or it is counterproductive.
Yeah,
not counterproductive.
And if the UFO people
yeah.
are just focusing on the UFO stuff, the ghost people are just looking at the ghost stuff. Cryptids are focusing on cryptid stuff. Then how can we look at the full spectrum of strange phenomena? How can we see the similarities and commonalities with all of it? Again, we have to kind of unite in that sense. Whether it's through events, whether it's through education, shows, whatever. I think all the different fields of research could do a better job in that regard.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?